This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So today, a story about the evolution of modern human thought. And our story begins about 600 years ago. In the winter of 1417, to be precise, our hero is an unassuming man who works for the Pope as a secretary and scribe. And he has a passion for books, in particular, old books, ancient Roman manuscripts.
And he has a great name, Poggio Bracciolini. Now, Bracciolini is a Florentine whose quest for those ancient manuscripts leads him to an old monastery in Germany. There, totally by chance, he unearths an ancient epic poem written by the Roman philosopher Lucretius in 50 BC. It's called On the Nature of Things.
Not exactly a sexy title.
No, but it contains some thrilling and explosively controversial ideas, especially for that time.
Among them, there is no creator and no grand plan. We are all made of minute particles, like atoms, the very same matter as the stars and oceans. There's no afterlife, and we should not live in fear of the gods, but in pursuit of pleasure.
Now, keep in mind, this was written in 50 BC. It was the literary discovery of Poggio Bracciolini's life. And according to our next guest, it would help shape the course of human thought, influence some of the world's greatest thinkers, from Galileo to Einstein, from Shakespeare to Thomas Jefferson. All this is part of Stephen Greenblatt's new book, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. Stephen Greenblatt is a Harvard Shakespeare scholar who wrote the best-selling Will and the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare. He lives in Cambridge, but he joins us today from NPR in Washington. And Stephen Greenblatt, great to have you on Radio Boston. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much, Anthony. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's just your book is so much fun. And I wanted to start where you start in the book, and that is with your discovery of this poem on the nature of things when you were a young student at Yale. Tell that story.
Well, I can't claim that it was one of the world's great discoveries found in a cave by the Dead Sea. I was rummaging around in a box of books for sale, remaindered books at the end of the year in the summer, or as the summer approached in college, and I found a paperback that had an alluring cover, a picture of two pairs of legs up in the sky. It wasn't quite clear what they were doing, but it looked interesting. And it cost 10 cents, which I had, I'm happy to say, and I decided to invest.
So it was the cover of those coupled legs doing possibly unmentionable things. That drew you into it.
I thought it would be fun to have on my shelf. I wasn't particularly interested in ancient physics, which I saw was the subject of the book, but I thought it would be interesting, and indeed it was interesting. Sometime over the summer, I picked it up, and I discovered that my 10-cent investment was actually an astonishing thing.
Well, so tell me what you were astonished by. This was a book by Lucretius on the nature of things. What was in there that astonished you?
First of all, it's a poem, a remarkably beautiful poem that begins with a spectacular, passionate hymn to the goddess of love, Venus, hence the cover of the book that I had found. And it is an ecstatic vision of the universe as coupling together untold millions, an infinite number of atoms joining together in the dance of the spring, the dance of reproduction. And then it went on from there to try to think through the nature of everything, the way things are. And what I discovered and what most astonished me initially, and maybe still, is that the work seemed to speak to me in the present, not as a work of from the distant past, from things that had long molded away into dust, but it seemed to be at my shoulder as a contemporary work, telling me that this is what the universe is like. This is what I see when I look up into the night sky at those stars. This is what I experience when I feel my own presence in the world. This is what I have to look forward to.
Now, we mentioned a couple of the principles that are outlined by Lucretius in this book in our introduction, but they're really astonishing, and they sound incredibly modern, especially when you consider that it was something written in 50 B.C. Can I just run through a couple of them?
Okay,
there is no afterlife. Death is nothing to us. You will not care because you will not exist. And I'm reading sort of loosely your paraphrases from the book. All organized religions are superstitious delusions. The delusions are based on deeply rooted longings, fears, and ignorance. A couple of other things. The universe has no creator or designer. And nature ceaselessly experiments. There's no single moment of origin. All living things, from plants, insects, to the higher mammals and man, have evolved through a long, complex process of trial and error. Sounds a lot like Darwin coming out of the 50 BC. It's quite astounding.
It is very strange, Anthony, isn't it? I mean, It starts with people lying down in the ancient Greek world and Roman world and looking at shafts of sunlight and noticing that there are innumerable tiny things dancing in that light. They knew those weren't the atoms because they were too big. You could see them, after all. Mm. But they began to wonder, what if that is the key to the nature of the universe? What if the universe, everything, we ourselves, the mountains and seas around us, what if this is all made up out of infinite numbers of tiny things dancing, the way these dust motes are dancing, banging into each other, coming apart, connecting, forever?
Yeah. Now, you explain as well early on in the book why this poem resonated so much with you personally. And it had something to do with your mother, her fear of death. I'm wondering if you could explain a little bit why this poem struck such a chord with you.
My mother had experienced what basically most people experienced before the 1930s, let's say, with the introduction of penicillin. Just the year before penicillin came in, my mother lost a younger sister to strep throat. This must have been part of the ordinary experience of most families, not just my family. And it left deep scars in my mother's. It left deep scars in people for centuries. Mm. We happen now to be blessed with some modest protection against these catastrophes. They happen much less frequently, and we're astonished and terrified when they do. But it was a much more frequent occurrence in the world of our grandparents and even of my parents. And my mother spent much of the rest of her life in the shadow of death and of fearing death. So when I read a work, and it hit me at just the right moment when things sometimes do, when I read a work that came from an unimaginably distant past that said, the fear of death is absurd. You shouldn't focus on death or the anxieties of disappearance. You should focus on now, on the miracle of your existence now, and take pleasure in that existence. It spoke to me as if it were a voice that had come from me personally.
Mm. So, Stephen Greenblatt, who was Lucretius? What do we know about him?
We don't know a lot about him, Anthony. We know that he was celebrated by at least some people in his time, by the poet Ovid and Virgil, as a great poet. We know that he was a contemporary of Cicero's, of Julius Caesar's. He lived in that period of the end of the Roman Republic, when the economy was falling apart, when the politicians were squabbling with each other, when the whole system seemed to be grinding to a halt, and when lots of people were asking themselves, what is it all about? But we don't know much about him personally. The few things that we know come of a personal kind come from much, much later, from a Christian source, St. Jerome, who may or may not have been telling reliable stories. What we know from inside the work is that Lucretius was a passionate follower of an older Greek philosopher named Epicurus.
Mm. And he's the sort of famous, or he's well known as sort of the philosopher of pleasure, I guess. Is that fair to, is that a fair way
yes.
to describe him?
Epicurean yeah. still
yeah, sure.
means
still has that.
Mean,
yeah.
I, and there's a, I consult a website called Epicurus that tells me how to cook very delicious food.
yeah.
But Epicurus himself actually was, for all we know, a rather modest living man who thought that pleasure, deep pleasure, the pleasure that mattered, was not about binge drinking or binge eating, but about finding a kind of inner calm,
mm.
and who tried to think of how to find that calm in relation to a vision of the way things are in the universe, the fact that this is all we have, that there's not going to be another round after we die, that we have to sort of seize what we can in this life.
So in Swerve, in your book, you show how this poem, written more than 2,000 years ago and almost lost forever, and I want to make sure we get to the fascinating story of how it was recovered in a moment, but you talk about how it becomes really the most radical and talked about essays of the Renaissance period and beyond. How was it received at first? I mean, I can imagine, and you write about this, that the church must not have loved it.
Yes, they regarded it as either insane or as wicked. That the things that you listed at the beginning and that we've talked about, the principles in that work, are like an inquisitor's manual of things to look out for, beliefs that you absolutely don't want to tolerate. On the other hand, the people who first found it saw immediately that it was extremely beautiful. They had very good Latin. They understood Latin poetry, and they saw that this was written in the manner of the great poets of Ovid and Virgil. They loved it. They actually wanted to use it as a schoolbook, and they did use it as a schoolbook because it's also a schoolmaster's dream, because it's incredibly difficult. So you could force your students to try to grapple with something at once important and difficult. And it was only after a century that they said, what? We can't use this as a schoolbook. And they banned it from the schools when they fully took in what it was saying. Mm. But the fact that it took them almost a century, Anthony, suggests that the message was so weird when it came back that it was difficult to get in focus as anything that a civilized Christian could believe in.
Mm. And you show the huge impact this poem ended up having on humanist thinkers, from the folks who were around the time when it was discovered to people like Machiavelli, Shakespeare, Montaigne, Thomas More, right up to Thomas Jefferson. How did it affect so many people?
Well, the impact at first is very much under the radar. That's the key thing to say. Mm. It's extremely dangerous, even if you could associate yourself with this work, even if you could see that it might make sense that the world is just made up out of atoms and void. You would get in horrible trouble if you identified publicly with this for centuries after the work came back. So the initial reception, with very few exceptions, is under the radar, but it's percolating. It's quietly making its way in the world. And it's really only after something like 200 years that it begins fully to surface. And when it does surface after almost 200 years, in 1600, let's say, when Giordano Bruno, the Italian philosopher, said, yes, this is the way the things are in the world, Bruno was dragged out and burned at the stake in Rome. So it was a very long process. And if it did influence things, as I think it did profoundly, it influenced things in subtle and indirect ways before it influenced them in the more direct and perceivable ways. Mm.
It shows up, you refer to how Shakespeare absorbed some of the principles of this poem. For example, in Romeo and Juliet, right? In the great scene before the lovers are going to kill themselves, they don't talk about some life ever after. They talk about it all just ending right there.
Yes. It's very strange because Shakespeare, we know Shakespeare's source for Romeo and Juliet. He took the story, tended in general to borrow things that were already in circulation. So he took the story from Italian sources that had Romeo and Juliet actually speak of their afterlife, of meeting in the afterlife, and of people after they're dead speaking of their being united in the afterlife. But Shakespeare dropped that. He dropped the idea that there was going to be an afterlife for Romeo and Juliet, and instead he had those remarkable lines of Juliet's about Romeo being cut up in little stars and making the world in love with night. And for that matter, he has a very strange thing, which is he makes a joke, he has Mercutio make a joke about the little atomies, he calls them, that are drawing the chariot on which Queen Mab, is floating across the nose of the dreamer. Now, he's not a private writer, Shakespeare. He's a public writer. So he expected some significant portion of the 2,000 listeners that he had in the theater to get and laugh at a joke about atoms in the 1590s. That means that a lot more was circulating, as they say, under the radar than we've realized.
So many things just amaze me about this story. I mean, beginning, and some of them are just so basic, and forgive me for asking this incredibly basic question, but I mean, the idea of atoms, I mean, Lucretius didn't actually use the word atom. I mean, clearly that concept wasn't understood at that point, or was it?
Oh, he didn't use the word atom, but that's because he wanted to find a Latin vocabulary for the Greek term. The Greeks used the term atom, and atom meant that which was not divisible, the indivisible thing, the thing that couldn't be cut up. Mm-hmm. The uncut upable thing was an atom. Mm. Now we know that we can cut up atoms, but they didn't know that. They tried to theorize, to conceptualize. This is all, of course, entirely speculative. It would take thousands of years before there would be any experimental basis for this line of thought. They tried to think of what the minimal building block of the world would be, and they said the minimal building block would be an indestructible, indivisible thing, which the Greeks called atoms, and which Lucretius called the seeds of things.
Mm. It's amazing, again, to think of someone in 50 B.C. Thinking like this. So Poggio Bracciolini, we can't let you go without talking about him, because, of course, your book, much of it reads like a detective story. Here's a 15th century papal secretary who has this passion for hunting, searching for these ancient manuscripts. He heads off to Germany. He finds it. And thus begins this extraordinary emergence, re-emergence of this poem. What do we know about Poggio Bracciolini? Who was he?
He was a poor guy. He came to Florence virtually penniless when he was a teenager. But he had one extraordinary possession, which was marvelous handwriting. Marvelous handwriting was his in the world of first of the Florentine chancellery, the government in Florence, which needed people with very good handwriting. And then he was able to parlay that into much more full and significant achievements. He managed to get, with letters of recommendation from his master in Florence, the job that everyone in the 1390s who was ambitious and on the make dreamed of getting, the equivalent of the Wall Street job from the 1980s, he got a job in the Vatican.
Mm.
And that job meant that you could make a lot of money, you could rise in the world. He became a papal scriptor, they called it, someone copying manuscripts and working in the Vatican court. And eventually he rose to the position of the apostolic secretary, a secretary very much with a sense, as it still has in it, of the word secret. Mm. He was in on the secrets of the various popes he worked for, and especially of the remarkable and very wicked pope he worked for just at the time that he made the discovery.
And he was an irreverent man, right? He called the Vatican the lie factory. Do I have that right?
He was a joke teller. Of course, the risk of the kind of job that he had, he never took orders, Poggio Bracciolini. He never became a priest. He said he didn't have a vocation for it. And he seems to have spent a lot of his time when he wasn't copying manuscripts in what he called the lie factory, telling jokes, most of them very much off color, about the world that he was in, about the priests and nuns and monks, and about the papal secretaries whom he was with. It became the most famous joke book of his age. There's a translation of it that was done in the 19th century, but into English, but a lot of the jokes end with Latin punchlines because they didn't dare to translate them because they are, as I say, off-color jokes. And the risk, in effect, of the life that he led was a risk, really, that it would just turn into fathomless cynicism. Hmm. And what seems to have saved him was this passion for ancient books.
Hmm.
So when he found himself in Germany with his boss, the Pope, not only thrown out of his position, but thrown into a dungeon out of office by the cardinals, Poggio found himself with time on his hands, and he went book hunting.
And he found this book. Now I learned from reading Swerve that eventually Poggio Bracciolini has the book copied by another Florentine named Niccolò Niccoli, and that this copy, one of these copies, still exists in a library in Florence, and that you actually went there and held it. What was that like for you?
Yes, this very copy does exist still, and it's thrilling to see. Mm. Niccolò Niccoli also had magnificent handwriting. It took him years to make the copy. He drove Poggio, poor man, out of his mind, waiting for it to come back from Niccolò Niccoli. But the copy is in the Laurentian Library in Florence. That's the library that was designed for the Medici by Michelangelo. And you sit in, it's actually a rather modest reading room, not in the grand rooms that Michelangelo designed, but in a reading room for scholars. And you sit in the reading room and they give you some gloves and bring out this amazing thing, which is the copy that brought back from the ancient world the whole lost idea of the universe made up out of atoms and emptiness and an endless dance of matter.
Mm. There's so much more I want to ask you. Our time is almost up. I do want to ask you one last question in the few seconds that remain. What does Lucretius, this poem, offer us today after more than 2,000 years?
What is remarkable about Lucretius, of course, we know on a different scientific set of terms, experimental set of terms from Einstein and from Darwin, we have confirmation, in effect, of many of the suppositions, the wild speculations in Lucretius. So he doesn't directly give us that. What he gives us is something else. Lucretius was perhaps the greatest moment in the history of the world, of a perfect conjunction of scientific speculation and magnificent poetry. That is to say, the conjunction of science and the humanities. Mm. And what Lucretius gives us is a glimpse of what it would be like if poetry and science could be married together. And for me, that's still the great, great thrill of this magnificent work.
Well, Stephen Greenblatt, we have to leave it there. The book is The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. Stephen Greenblatt is the John Cogan University Professor of the Humanities at Harvard. Stephen Greenblatt, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anthony.
Stay with us. Up next, a survey of the vibrant and growing Boston rap and hip-hop scene. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.